40 years. Before I proceed any further, just please turn off your cell phones, and if you need translation equipment, it's available outside. There will be simultaneous translation available. Also, we want to thank Congressman Jim McGovern's office for reserving this space for us and making the arrangements and getting word out to members of Congress and staff about this event. And special thanks to Cindy Buell and Dan Holt, who made special efforts to ensure that this was a successful event. We also want to welcome our panelists, some of whom have traveled from Colombia. Another panelist came from Switzerland, for their willingness to share their expertise that they've garnered in their involvement as firsthand participants in a variety of negotiations. I'm David Smock. I'm Vice President of the U.S. Institute of Peace for Mediation and Conflict Resolution. This institution, USIP, was founded in 1984 by an act of Congress, so we are a child of Congress, and we're happy to be here in these premises. USIP's activities on Colombia are detailed in a handout that's available out on the table outside the door, but we have a special initiative by the grant program for Colombia. We're running a series of training programs. We're engaging the faith communities to reinforce their efforts to be peacemakers. We have a variety of publications that have both already appeared and are in process of publication. And we're especially privileged this year to have one of our senior fellows, Jennifer Shermer, who is an expert on Colombia and is working this year describing her activities to bring together Colombian military and former guerrillas. And you'll be hearing from her later on this morning. Jenny Bouvier at my left is a senior program officer in the Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program, and she will be moderating our discussion today. And she and Jennifer have worked closely together to design this program and ensure its success. Finally, a note about USIP. We are, as I said, created by Congress, but an independent nonpartisan institution, and so that the perspectives that will be shared today by the speakers do not necessarily reflect the views of USIP, since we do not advocate policy prescriptions. We'll begin the program this morning with opening remarks by Congressman Jim McGovern. Congressman McGovern needs no introduction to those of you who have followed Colombia closely and U.S. policies toward that country. He's been one of a handful of leaders in Congress who have worked diligently to craft a U.S. policy that supports human rights and promotes peace in Colombia. He spearheaded numerous initiatives in this regard. We appreciate the deep personal interest and engagement that's motivated the Congressman's regular visits to Colombia and to other parts of Latin America, and we're grateful to have him here to make the lead-off presentation. Congressman McGovern.
Well, thank you very much. And first of all, let me thank the U.S. Institute for Peace for coordinating today's briefing. And I want to thank USIP Vice President David Smock and Ginny Bouvier and Jennifer Shermer for their work on Colombia, especially on the neglected topic of how to end the conflict that has cost so many lives and livelihoods over the past 40 years. I should note that I had the pleasure of traveling to Colombia with Ginny Bouvier in 2003 as part of a fact-finding delegation organized by the Washington Office on Latin America, and we learned a lot on that trip and on subsequent trips as well. Let me begin by saying that peacekeeping is a neglected topic inside and outside of Colombia. Too much time, effort, and resources are focused on military solutions, not just to the various armed conflicts, the paramilitaries, the FARC, the ELN, but to ending the cultivation of illegal crops, emptying conflict zones of their civilian populations by forcible displacement, and making intractable demands of negotiations so that continued armed conflict remains the only option left on the table. Now, I believe there is hope for changing this dynamic in Colombia, but it will take a great deal of political will for that to happen, on the part of all the armed actors inside Colombia, the United States, and the international community. I'm optimistic because, like anyone who has actually taken the time to travel around Colombia and meet directly with local community leaders, there is a genuine grassroots movement in support of locally developed development and peace initiatives. Some of these locally initiated peace agreements might ultimately serve as a national model for peace. In more limited terms, these local and regional initiatives have the capacity of forming a network of zones where conflict has significantly diminished, allowing local economic and development initiatives to move forward. Now, on the pessimistic side, these local and regional initiatives receive precious little support from the Colombian state. Their local leaders often get targeted for death by all the armed actors, including the Colombian Armed Forces, and too often they operate in isolation. I do want to thank the European Union for providing many of these local projects with funding, modest though it may be. The initiatives that will be discussed in more detail this morning are among the most interesting and promising in Colombia right now. And once again, the optimistic hope is that they could help build confidence among antagonists and the Colombian population at large that peace is possible. But there's nothing easy about solving these conflicts. Each effort faces significant hurdles. Each has its own set of drawbacks. The demobilization of paramilitaries is a case in point. Now, everyone supports seeing one of the most violent, illegal armed actors leave the battlefield, disarm, and commit itself and its members to renouncing violence and illegal operations in exchange for reentering lawful civilian life. Only it hasn't worked out that way. Thousands of so-called demobilized paramilitaries are unaccounted for. A pitiful number of arms were turned in. Illegal financial networks remain intact, and thousands of paramilitaries have reconstituted themselves into criminal mafia-like networks or into new paramilitary organizations. So the process needs to be strengthened, improved, and made to work, or redone altogether to achieve its aims, including holding accountable those who committed gross violations of human rights and other crimes. Negotiations between the Colombian government and the ELN, the smaller of the two guerrilla organizations, appear promising, but seem to be constantly in motion, but never near conclusion. These negotiators benefit from the engagement of Cuba and a group of European nations who have helped keep the negotiations alive and moving forward. They also benefit from being under the radar screen and allowed to go through fits and starts without the intense scrutiny of the media or criticisms by opponents of such talks. Then there is the subject of negotiations with the FARC. Currently, there are no peace negotiations with the FARC, which is why the proposal put forward by the governments of Spain, France, and Switzerland is so important. This proposal, known as the Humanitarian Accord, is an effort to facilitate an exchange of FARC prisoners for Colombian and international hostages being held by the FARC. It is truly a humanitarian effort to help humanize the war and to try and build some level of confidence and success at talks that might lead the government and FARC to once again sit down at the table and negotiate a lasting peace. Now, I, along with six of my colleagues, Representatives Schakowsky, Grijalva, Welsh, Hinchy, Farr, and Delahunt, have made a commitment to the Spanish, French, Swiss, and Colombian governments and to the FARC that we support the Humanitarian Accord Initiative and that we are willing to stand witness to negotiations and a prisoner exchange if such actions on our part might be helpful. We are grateful for how positively the European sponsors of this initiative, the Uribe government and the FARC, have responded to our modest offer. And I know that we will all be interested in the panel presentations on the status and the future of the Humanitarian Accord. But it is our opinion that if we can move forward on such an initiative in a successful way, that it really could be a confidence builder. It could set the stage for more such agreements on various other aspects of dispute in this conflict. It is certainly true that the major cities of Colombia are more secure than they have been in a decade or more, but they are not free from politically motivated violence. And sadly, the level of threats and intimidation against human rights defenders, labor leaders, victims' rights organizations, and other civil society leaders is as high or higher than ever before. The number of Colombia's internally displaced is around 3.8 million, second only to Sudan, and an additional 200,000 Colombians are internally displaced every year. In the rural departments and areas of Colombia, violence continues to be the rule, not the exception. In many regions of Colombia, like Nariño, there is a humanitarian crisis going on and no one to help. Those who suffer the most are the poor, our women, and our children, and members of minority communities such as Afro-Colombians and indigenous peoples. Peace is the number one imperative for Colombia. So I want to thank the U.S. Institute for Peace and its panelists for coming to Washington and trying to shed some light on this neglected topic, and I look forward to hearing the discussion here today. So thank you.
I'd like to thank Congressman McGovern for his leadership and his vision, his inspiration, and above all, his courage on matters having to do with Colombia. Before I introduce our other speakers, I'd like to say just a few words about the context for today's briefing. Since the early 1980s, Colombian governments have alternated between strategies of war and strategies of peace in their dealings with illegal armed actors. Several governments have engaged in negotiations with guerrilla groups, which have led to the disarmament or partial disarmament of at least five guerrilla groups. And successive governments have, albeit unsuccessfully, repeatedly attempted to reach peace agreements with each of the two major guerrilla groups, the FARC, the Colombian Revolutionary Armed Forces, and the National Liberation Army, the ELN. In recent years, the Uribe government has focused its primary efforts on demobilizing the paramilitary umbrella organization known as the AUC. This paramilitary process, the controversial justice and peace law which is regulating it, and the unraveling parapolitical revelations have garnered considerable public attention and debate both within Colombia and here in Washington. We have heard much less, particularly in Washington, about what is happening with other armed groups. While the Colombian government's strategy toward the FARC continues to be primarily military, there are increasing pressures to negotiate a humanitarian accord involving a hostage-for-prisoner exchange as both an end in itself and as a confidence-building measure, as Congressman McGovern has noted. There is nonetheless strong opposition from those advocating military rescue operations over such an accord. With regard to the ELN, in late 2005, a civil society commission created the House of Peace to facilitate a consultation process between Colombian civil society and the ELN. This led to a series of formal meetings between the ELN and the Colombian government in Havana, Cuba, where a sixth round of talks is now underway. Today's meeting will focus on the ELN process, the humanitarian accord with the FARC, and the role of the international community in supporting peace efforts in Colombia. We're delighted to have with us today four speakers who have each been actively engaged in trying to resolve various aspects of the conflict in Colombia. We've provided a short biographical summary of each of their relevant backgrounds. We begin with an analysis of current initiatives with the ELN and the humanitarian accord. First, Leon Valencia on my far right, political analyst, essayist, columnist, novelist, and president of the Corporación Nuevo Arco Iris, will update us on new and exciting developments in the ELN peace process. Mr. Valencia brings to his analysis a unique perspective, as he was a member of the ELN Central Command in the 1980s, until in 1994 he participated in the signing of a peace agreement with the Colombian government for the demobilization of one sector of that organization. He's been close to the Havana talks as they have unfolded. Then Angela Giraldo, to his left, peace commissioner of the government of Valle del Cauca and representative of the relatives of the group of deputies kidnapped by the FARC, will speak about the humanitarian accord and the opportunities it might offer for paving the way toward negotiations with the FARC. Angela, too, brings a particular perspective to this task. As her brother, Francisco Giraldo, a Valle del Cauca departmental legislator, was kidnapped by the FARC in 2002 and continues to be held. In our second panel, to my left, we'll look at European experiences in supporting peace processes in Colombia. Norway, Switzerland, and Spain mediated the recent series of ELN talks with the logistical support of Cuba and Venezuela. The governments of France, Spain, and Switzerland have been accompanying the humanitarian accord initiative that Congressman McGovern mentioned. Our first speaker on this second panel will be Remy Friedman, to my left, head of the Colombia Peace Policy Program at the Swiss Federal Department of Foreign Affairs in Switzerland. Mr. Friedman will speak about the role of the international community in peace processes, and in particular about the role of the Swiss in the ELN and FARC processes. Mr. Friedman has been following Colombia's conflict for the past decade, first as a human rights officer for the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and then as a peace-building advisor at the Swiss Embassy in Bogota. Finally, we will hear from Jennifer Schirmer on preparing the ground for peace, informal avenues for dialogue. Jennifer has been a driving force behind today's program and is currently a senior fellow at USIP. She was formerly a senior researcher at the Center for Development and the Environment at the University of Oslo and a consultant for the Norwegian Foreign Ministry. She will discuss Norwegian initiatives in which she has been engaged, including the facilitation of dialogues between the military and ex-guerrillas as an avenue for building peace. I've asked each speaker to limit their remarks to 8 to 10 minutes in order to leave time for your questions. If you haven't already done so, for those who arrived late, please be sure that your cell phones are turned off. And now we'll start with Leon Valencia, and I'll ask each speaker to please come to the podium.
Muchas gracias al Instituto por la Paz de esta.
I thank the United States Institute of Peace for holding this meeting on topics that are so close to my heart, and I also thank Congressman McGovern for being with us today and for the interest that he has demonstrated in Colombia and in Colombia's problems and in the aid that he can give to our country. I also thank Ginny, Jennifer, and David from the Institute for the work that they have been doing on behalf of Colombia. I have been speaking with the delegation of the ELN that is negotiating a peace accord in Havana, Cuba, between April 29th and 30th of this year. And I also had the opportunity to talk with the High Commissioner for Peace in Colombia during that visit. Also, last Monday, I had the opportunity to speak with the ELN delegation once again. And there is some important good news for Colombia in this and also for the international community. The ELN and the Colombian government are on the verge of reaching an agreement for a ceasefire and cessation of hostilities in Colombia. This is the first time that the ELN has agreed to a cessation of hostilities, and that's very important. It is a guerrilla force that has been in the bush for 40 years. They have a very long history. So this is big news. There are issues that the country is expectant about with regard to the cessation of hostilities, such as the hostages. This is part of the cessation of hostilities agreement. The demining of areas in which there have been so many people affected by anti-personnel landmines. Also, the return of some campesino communities who were displaced by the conflict, and also the possibility that some ELN prisoners may come out of jail, and also the possibility for the ELN to conduct political activity with the civil society during the ceasefire in order to prepare themselves for the next phase of the peace process. The ELN has been engaged in talks with the Colombian government for 20 months in Havana, and they've been going through what is called the exploratory phase of negotiations. On May 2nd, they began the second phase, which is that of a temporary and experimental ceasefire. And the third phase would be what they call the phase of negotiating a final peace agreement. These negotiations obviously have many meet up with many obstacles, and it's not so easy to reach a peace accord with the guerrilla group that has a long history of political uprising, and they have a lot of pride behind them, such as the presence of great leaders such as Father Camilo Torres in their ranks, and a guerrilla group which of course has caused a lot of damage in the country and which has to answer for many things within the country, because so this negotiation is not easy. However, hopes have been raised that they can reach a final peace agreement. This is a guerrilla force that has work or groups in 23 departments or provinces, so it's virtually spread throughout the country. So these groups are not militarily strong compared to the FARC or the paramilitary groups. And this is partially because of political decisions taken by the ELN as well. Over the past 10 years, there has been a different dynamic of the war in Colombia, in which the paramilitary groups and the FARC worked hand in hand with the drug traffickers. And this gave them tremendous military resources with which to wage war. But the ELN decided to not get involved with drug trafficking. And some guerrilla fronts have been using this. They have been like collecting taxes, but they have not really been engaged in drug trafficking, and there has been some extradition, but this has led to a more favorable climate for negotiations, although there are problems. The ELN also did not get involved in occupying territory at the expense of the population and dispelling people from the areas in which they live. So there are many crimes on their shoulders, and they are accused of many things in terms of violations of human rights and violations of the humanitarian accords. However, in the case of the ELN, this has not been as serious because the ELN has not been as aggressive to the civilian population over the last 10 years. So it is a guerrilla group that is perhaps in a more favorable position for negotiating peace. However, they do need a lot of international support, and they need people to be with them. They have demonstrated a particular interest to have the United States government and Congress accompany this peace process. It's a situation that we just went through with the paramilitaries, as Congressman McGovern was just saying. There is a great problem. A lot of questions have been raised in the negotiations with the paramilitary groups. So this negotiation needs to take place before they negotiate with the FARC, which is a much stronger guerrilla group, which is much more entrenched in the territory than the ELN. In fact, the peace negotiations with the ELN are being attacked by the FARC, and they have been attacked by the FARC in recent months, and many people in the ELN have been killed by the FARC. Of course, the ELN has also caused casualties on the FARC side, but it has heightened aggression. The ELN seems to be the group that was hardest hit by the paramilitaries, and the paramilitaries that Congressman McGovern was talking about do have a presence where the ELN exists. So that's a lot of people who are left out of the peace accord. So this is a process that needs to have the international community, that needs the accompaniment of the international community. And it would be very important for both the United States Congress and the United States administration to accompany this peace negotiating process and to understand that this guerrilla group can serve as a model for negotiations with the FARC and for the new round of negotiations that is needed with the paramilitary groups. These are negotiations in which they really will get into topics of truth, justice, and reparations with such forms as transitional justice and ways that will find solutions to the drug trafficking problem in the country, which has had such an important role in the war in Colombia, and a negotiating process which will come back to political positions, which has been lost in Colombia. So these negotiations will have to include reconciliation and transformation of Colombian society so that once and for all, people can stop using violence as an instrument of political action. Because not only the guerrillas are not the only ones who have used violence for political tools in Colombia, but the government leadership, even the state, have used violence as a form of political struggle. The evidence is very clear. Over the last 10 years, the political elites have been involved with the paramilitaries and they have taken over political power in 12 departments this way. More than 80 congresspeople who have been engaged with the paramilitaries had an impact on the central government as well. And they've taken, this has had a tragedy of tremendous proportion in Colombia. So we need to begin to visualize the possibility of establishing a model for negotiations that will enable us to have reconciliation and to lay out a path for the FARC and for the paramilitary group so that we can have authentic reconciliation in Colombia. Thank you very much.
Angela, si quieres acercarte.
Angela Giraldo will now speak. Greetings to everyone who is here today, and my special thanks to the United States Institute of Peace, to Virginia and Jennifer for taking such an interest in these issues in Colombia. I also thank Mr. Arujo, who has been a colleague in our fight for the humanitarian accord, and fortunately now his father has been released, but still many people are still abducted. As Congressman McGovern said, the issue with the FARC and those of us who are working on the humanitarian accord is to try to humanize the conflict and to apply international humanitarian law in Colombia. In order to do this, we need to start by acknowledging that in Colombia there is an internal armed conflict. We are not the only ones saying this, but a recent survey showed that 89% of Colombians feel that there truly is an armed conflict in Colombia, and the International Committee of the Red Cross has published a report to this effect on the Internet. So we see that there is an armed conflict which uses terrorist methods, and there is an armed conflict, however. For this reason, we need to find a way to humanize it. As has been stated, there are negotiations with the ELN. It has gone through several stages, and they are now on the verge of reaching agreements which will make it possible to begin a serious peace process with the ELN. We have also seen the negotiations with the AUC, which has enabled us to demobilize a large number of the self-defense forces. However, it has not yet been possible to have a dialogue with the FARC. Colombia's jails do not have members of the leadership of the FARC. Simon Trinidad and Commander Ansonia are not members of the FARC secretariat. We must acknowledge, however, that we have been able to get the guerrillas out of the urban areas and that they have retreated. However, the guerrilla movement continues to be strong in spite of the fact that they have retreated from the cities. And it is not feasible for the government to militarily defeat the FARC, nor is it likely for the FARC to take over government power through violence. This is why we are appealing to international humanitarian law to try to save the lives of the people who have been abducted. The group of kidnapped victims who were previously called exchangeable, the ones who they never requested money for their freedom. There are 56 people who continue to live in captivity. This includes members of the National Congress. There is a former presidential candidate, a woman. There are members of the Assembly of Valle del Cauca. There is Senator Meto, and there are three American contractors. Not congressmen, contractors. And it is important for the United States to also take on this cause. We, of course, thank Congressman Jim McGovern for his efforts in signing letters on their behalf. This really has helped. So these people who were said to be exchangeable, the only chance of them coming emerging alive from their captivity, well, the ones in the military and the police have been kidnapped for some 10 years, and they have never been able to leave. Pinchado was recently released. He was a police superintendent, and he fled. He escaped. But it is highly unlikely that all 56 of the other hostages will be able to escape, and it is also very unlikely to have a military rescue operation to save all 56 people. So it seems that there is no way that you can release them without putting their lives at risk. So in this struggle for a humanitarian accord, we have gone through several phases. Usually President Uribe would say that the guerrillas have to leave the country, that it was not necessary to sit down and negotiate with them face to face, and that it was not possible to enter into dialogue with the guerrillas. However, over the past 5 years that I have been involved in the process, President Uribe has gone through different phases. Some days he is for and against the different options. Right now, the negotiations are stagnated. The president says that he will release, that he is willing to release all of the guerrilla prisoners. However, that release will not be done through an agreement. For that reason, there is nothing to get the FARC to commit to release the people who are in captivity. And an important part of the accord is not only to let the guerrillas come out of the jails, but it is also important for the hostages in the jungles to be released. For this reason, we need confidence-building measures, as Congressman McGovern was saying, which can facilitate their release in the future. While it would not replace the peace process, it would be a first step down that path. What are the confidence-building measures at present? The FARC says that there must be an area with no military presence, and the area that they have requested, the zone, are the municipalities of Florida and Pradera. These municipalities are located in the state that I am from, which is in Valle del Cauca. In that zone, there is some trust among the local and municipal government. They are willing to remove military forces from there. The governor of Valle del Cauca is ready to do this. However, President Uribe is not willing to remove military forces. It is important to understand that the removal of military forces does not mean that one would be ceding national sovereignty. As Congressman McGovern has said, There is institutional accompaniment from Spain, France, Switzerland, and the Democratic Congress people of the United States. This lends legitimacy to the process. However, the president would not be giving up sovereignty. He would simply be allowing a humanitarian presence in Colombia so that these people can be released alive from the FARC captivity. And what we are trying to accomplish through the humanitarian accord is to protect the lives of the people who are in captivity. They are now sleeping on top of explosive devices. Now, don't take this from me. This is what people who have been escaped captivity who have said this. They know that any time they may be blown up. They also are surrounded by landmines. Two people have managed to escape. We have our Minister of Foreign Relations, Fernando Rujo, and also Pinchado, who recently escaped. But they were the lucky ones. I wonder whether the 56 people that are still there would be as fortunate. In the Urao rescue, which was done in May of 2003, 8 people died. The governor of Antioquia, his peace counselor, and 8 police and military officers. So 10 people died in this military rescue. So we can have a humanitarian accord. We can declare a demilitarized zone. It's not simply a matter. It is a matter of humanizing the conflict. And I know that in the view of the Colombian government, it is much more important to take this stance because the humanitarian accord is precisely what will get the FARC engaged. Otherwise, I don't see any national or international talks. If we could overcome this bottleneck, then I know we will be able to have the national government and the FARC sit down. We're talking about 45 days. We're not saying that it would be an endless demilitarized zone. This area would be surrounded by international observers, and the proposal made by Spain, France, and Switzerland would be supported by the Democratic Congress people. It will be institutional. There will be security, and this will allow the kidnapped victims to be released. Unfortunately, this seems to be a bottleneck, a sticking point between the national government and the FARC. But we feel that someone needs to take the first step. And I'm certain that in order to legitimize the process, the President Uribe needs to take the first step. This would be a sign of maturity, and I think that we need our support. We also see in the INDEPAS survey published in March of 2007, so we see that we do enjoy political support. We do have the support of our friendly countries, and it would be very good for Colombia. And so we want to make a special appeal to the members of the U.S. Congress. Do not allow the humanitarian accord to be used as a banner of opposition to the national government, but we need to convince the government of the United States and Congress people. You need to work on behalf of the 3 U.S. citizens who are in the hands of the FARC. This should be used as a negotiating tool for the free trade agreement. There are 56 defenseless people whose lives are in danger every day. It would not harm Colombia. It would be a way to save human lives, and this would be very important. The letters sent by Congress people to Colombia had some very positive results. And this will help to get President Uribe to decide to engage in a humanitarian accord. Thank you very much.
Congressman McGovern, for staying through this, and suggest that perhaps we let all of the speakers speak now and take advantage of your presence here, and then open the floor to questions for both panels of speakers. So, Remy, would you like to go next?
Distinguished Congressman McGovern, dear co-panelists, dear friends, ladies and gentlemen, I would like, first of all, to express my gratitude to Virginia Bouvier and David Smock of the United States Institute for Peace and to Congressman McGovern for giving me the opportunity to address this audience and expose the role of Switzerland in the group of countries that have accompanied Colombia in the search for a peaceful solution to the conflict it has suffered for the last decades. I will try now to highlight the comprehensive aspect of our peace promotion efforts, which is made of a combination of interventions at various levels. Swiss activities in favor of peace and human rights in Colombia are part of a broader engagement that lies at the heart of Switzerland's foreign policy and is in line with its humanitarian tradition. Since the adoption of a new framework for a civilian conflict handling and human rights promotion policy in 2002, Switzerland has provided its good offices and contributed to the de-escalation of conflicts and negotiated solutions in contexts like Nepal, Guatemala, the Great Lakes region of Africa, the Balkans, Sudan, and Indonesia, and continues to be active in different regions around the world. This policy is based on the experience and the conviction that in order to achieve sustainable results in the promotion of peace and human rights, it is necessary to intervene at different levels. We have better chances to generate long-term effects if political and diplomatic activities with national governments or rebel movements are completed by a long-term engagement on the side of civil society. This approach relies as well as on a know-how on different thematic issues related to human rights and peace, power sharing and federalism, dealing with the past, transitional justice, relationship with Islamic foundations, the gender role in peace issues, the human rights of internally displaced people, and on a network of like-minded countries, international organizations, NGOs, and academic institutions. Colombia is one of the countries of priority within the Swiss peace and human rights policy. This commitment is based on the belief that a peace negotiation between the parties to the conflict will have more chances to succeed if the different segments of the society are able to bring the proposals into the discussion and if the full respect of human rights and international humanitarian law is upheld. Switzerland has worked in Colombia for several years with different multi and bilateral partners, taking into account the situation of the main victims of the conflict, particularly women, ethnic minorities, and internal displaced, who, though they haven't taken the decision to take part to the conflict, are actors of peace and must be supported in a coherent peace policy. In this spirit, Switzerland has been carrying out the following operational activities in the last years. First, the facilitation of peace efforts with the objective of putting into place a structured, sustainable, and participative peace process with the armed groups. I will come back to this later. Second, the transfer of competencies allowing the application of the principles of transitional justice in the demobilization process of ancient combatants, particularly the paramilitaries, in the respect of the rights to truth, justice, and full reparation for the victims. Switzerland supports through technical expertise in a partnership with the International Center for Transitional Justice of New York, the efforts of state institutions like the National Commission on Reparation and Reconciliation, and victims' organizations for the implementation of mechanisms allowing the recovery of the memory, reparation for the victims, and application of justice. Third activity, the promotion of the participation of all sectors and segments of society, private sector, NGOs, trade unions, ethnic and minorities, women groups, peasants, and so on. The Swiss government supports, in a partnership with Swiss NGOs, a program that has the objective of strengthening civil society initiatives for peace and support local initiatives in order to create synergies with the peace facilitation efforts. Fourth, the promotion and reinforcement of the respect for human rights and international humanitarian law through the support to international organizations like the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights of the United Nations, state institutions, and NGOs active in this field. Let me now refer more specifically to our peace facilitation efforts. Switzerland has strived since 2002 to facilitate a mechanism for a dialogue between the FARC and the Colombian government in view of a humanitarian agreement for the release of hostages, considering that it would be a first step towards a real peace process. The proposal presented to the parties by France, Spain, and Switzerland in December 2005, called a Security System for a Humanitarian Encounter in the Cordillera Central, foresees a meeting between the government and the FARC in the central Andean region of Colombia, guaranteed by the presence of international observers. The Colombian government made public its acceptation shortly after receiving the proposal, but the FARC have maintained their demand of the demilitarization of two municipalities as a precondition for such an encounter to take place. The three countries have, however, continued working around this proposal, and the technical mission has traveled several times to Colombia, exploring the area and meeting separately with both parties in order to study possible improvements to reach a compromise. The three countries have also publicly appealed to the FARC to provide proofs of life of the hostages. The letter of support sent by the seven United States members of Congress to the Colombian government and to the three countries' foreign ministers is of utmost importance and underlines that the proposal remains the best at hand at the present moment. The members of Congress offer to be present in the area where the talks will take place is highly significant and has been welcomed by the three foreign ministers because it represents a great source of encouragement and motivates us to take further action on reaching a humanitarian agreement. We will continue to work in that direction and be available to help Colombia to find a solution that does not result in violence. The three countries haven't relented their efforts. They continue to be intense but discreet, as this remains necessary in order to achieve a result. We cannot be satisfied, however, until the hostages recover their freedom. There is place for hope when we look at the current peace talks with the ELN. Since December 2005, Norway, Spain, and Switzerland are accompanying the peace dialogues between the Colombian government and this guerrilla group. In this context, we have followed the different rounds of talks that have taken place in La Habana, Cuba, and have supported the peace house in Medellin. The sixth round of talks that started mid-April is expected to culminate in a first agreement that would incorporate a ceasefire, as well as a thematic agenda for a final settlement. The three countries' role has been until now to support and legitimize the process. At the beginning of the current round of talks, the three countries have been called in as witnesses in order to enhance the trust between the parties. Now that substantial and difficult issues are being treated, the parties may call on the international community to help with expertise on matters like verification of a ceasefire, transitional justice, public participation, etc., and one can foresee as well a role for the United Nations and the Organization of American States when it will come to the monitoring of the implementation of agreements. It is, however, up to the parties to determine what role the international community can play to help this process move forward. The road ahead is still paved with enormous difficulties, but we have noted the willingness and the commitment on both sides. Dear friends, as far as Switzerland is concerned, we are ready to help and provide assistance when requested by the parties. The combination of diplomatic efforts, dialogue with the authorities, interlocution with the armed groups, support to projects in favor of civil society and strengthening of human rights, this is how we hope to contribute to a peaceful solution for Colombia. May the United States Congress join us in these efforts. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Remy. Next, we'll have Jennifer Shermer.
Thank you very much for all of you for coming today. As we've heard from Congressman McGovern and our Swiss colleague, the presence and commitment of international actors, especially Europeans, in the peace processes in Colombia as third-party facilitators and mediators is remarkable. Norway, together with Spain and Switzerland, has played a facilitation role in the ELN process in Havana for the last 20 months, which is now bearing tremendous fruit, as Leon has described. And I'd like to underscore his call for us to visualize the new model of negotiation for Colombia in which the third party can actually encourage and be part of this new process of peace. But I'd like today quickly talk about how internationals, and particularly Europeans, can also play a more informal role, more low-profile role in Colombia in preparing the ground that can complement these formal channels for peace settlements and humanitarian exchanges, as Angelo was speaking about. And these informal avenues can be very critical in engaging with groups that are often marginalized in the process that lead to peace and represent absolutely difficult armed actors, in these processes, serving as spoilers in the long, long history of Colombia. And normally when one speaks of informal avenues, we think primarily of non-governmental organizations. And these have an important role to play But sometimes they have a history in a country which can maybe help and sometimes hinder dialogue activities. They may also be reluctant to participate for their own reasons and their own security in more inclusive dialogues. And so this is a part that internationals, in fact, can begin to engage in these issues of spoilers and begin to engage with armed actors. Because armed actors remain a critical element for sustaining peace once it is actually signed. And so this is another space, kind of action, that internationals can be part of. Because they do not depend on a past history, a past failed negotiations, and they can reflect a desire and a commitment for neutrality, for inclusiveness in resolving the conflict in a much more peaceful manner rather than as a military option. And sometimes these can serve, this is kind of informal activities, for example, the one I'll speak about today on dialogues, is in may in fact engage those precisely those actors who we can focus on as potential spoilers. Now, the effort funded by Norway and by the Institute of Peace is a project through a university in Norway between the military and civil society in Colombia to skill all sides in a language and a conduct of human rights and peacemaking. And it is not easily identified with one sector of another. In fact, its very strength is being one, international, and two, neutral in its position. And this means that the project is very left unencumbered by an official position of this or that organization or government. And it provides a neutral space, which is very critical to the development of trust and dialogue. And so it's a very small, low-profile project funded over the last 6 years, known as the Peace-Skilling Project, in which we have brought together armed actors, military security forces, together with ex-guerrillas and members of civil society, including the more progressive elements of the new Polo Democratico Party. And this is, in many ways, a new kind of preparation of crossing boundaries, because the question we have to ask is, wouldn't it be better to engage armed actors in an effort to influence how they think about peace long before a peace process may be signed? Wouldn't access to and dialogue with both non-state guerrillas on one side and state security forces and civil society on the other provide us with a significant advantage of sustaining a peace once a process is signed? So the question here is, what could a third party, an international party, particularly a European international party, do to make armed actors comfortable in coming together in a dialogue, speaking about and listening to civilians and ex-guerrillas, and eventually guerrillas, and vice versa, to move discussions along toward resolving the peace, rather than leaving it to history to watch yet another peace process fail or fall prey to spoilers? These conversations, which have been off the record and low profile for the last 7 years in Colombia, are 15 dialogues that we have had with about 250 officers and over 60 civilians in Colombia, with themes to generate debate, frank debate, but respectful debate. And these have included the issue of paramilitarism, the issue of land reform, the issue of economic costs of war, the policies of new progressive mayors in Cali, Bogota, and Medellin with regard to trade unionism, with regard to protecting trade unionists, with regard to rehabilitation of ex-paramilitary youths, and together with the issue of the peace process with the ELN. And so these conversations, by taking them out of the more polemical world of Colombia and placing them in a more neutral space in which all can speak in a respectful but open way, can lead, as we begin to see, in a very concurrences of thinking and transformation of attitudes. I don't want to make huge claims here, but the results we have seen are slow but discernible. in a society as socially fragmented as Colombia, it is unusual for people from one sector to speak to another. And we now have officers willing to meet with left-wing trade unionists, with human rights lawyers, with mayors, ex-guerrillas, and are very, very interested in discussing the political resolution to the conflict. Many of them are very interested in this and not in the military solution. We now have civilians who are much more willing to engage in dialogue with officers as potential partners in peace building, rather than simply assuming that they will be spoilers. And finally, we now have the issue of conflict resolution on the table as a legitimate topic. So I would like to end with kind of lessons for the international community in terms of informal avenues to prepare the ground for processes, a willingness to support informal outreach to those often marginalized by the peace process and thus feel very suspicious of peace, very anxious and threatened by peace. An understanding of the importance of laying the ground for peace and allowing a project latitude to speak to all actors at the table and not just certain ones. The issue of inclusiveness here is extraordinarily important. A willingness to focus in a constructive manner on peace issues, while at the same time the government still maintains a clear position on human rights and international humanitarian law. In other words, engagement with armed actors, let me make this clear, does not cancel out government denunciation of violations. The fact that this project was allowed to be independent meant that the work continued through many periods of intergovernmental tension. 4, getting involved in preparing the ground long before there are signs of a peace process, and maintaining a dialogue independent of that process in many ways. It actually, this project was born during the negotiations with the FARC in 1998, but when those talks fell apart in early 2002, the project was able to continue. So it should be continued, but independent of specific dynamic of the process itself. And finally, having patience and can't expect immediate results. Norway, together with its formal facilitation on the ELM process, have been willing to maintain support of this project for 7 years, understanding how much time it takes to build such trust based on 48 years of conflict. So the problem, again, lies in the long-standing separation of social sectors and long history of mutual silence and enmity between them, that internationals with the neutrality, with their resources, with their inclusiveness and their concerns, can help to overcome by supporting actions that make it possible to rise above these social barriers to dialogue and eventually to peace. I would also like to point out that the two other members of the team here with me today, León Valencia and Alberto Lara, were part of this low-profile outreach on these dialogues, and I wanted to thank them for their tremendous efforts in this. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank all four of our panelists for their insightful and knowledgeable remarks and for bringing their experience to this to the halls of the U.S. Congress. I'd like to open the floor for questions. I would ask that you stand up, identify yourself. I will need to repeat the question from here in order for it to be heard in our translation booth. And I'd like to recognize also our translators, Barry Olson and Jill Clark Gollop, for their good work in the back booth. And the first question. Okay, so we have a question on U.S. policy. Congressman McGovern, would you like to take that one?
Yeah.